Hi, I'm Jared Krause. I'm the host of the Buying Online Businesses podcast, and today I'm speaking with Justin Cook, who is the co-founder and the CMO of Empire Flippers. They have sold close to $500 million worth of online businesses and have changed the lives of many business owners who've sold and acquired businesses through them. Being one of the industry leaders, many of my clients have bought businesses and sold businesses from Empire Flippers, as they typically just have such a great high caliber and range of online businesses to acquire. Now, in this podcast episode, Justin and I just have a good old chin wag. It was like chatting to a friend that we hadn't chatted to in a long time. We talk about what Justin has learned in the last 14 years since starting Empire Flippers and in the M&A realm, mergers and acquisitions. We'll just talk about how acquiring online businesses has changed in that period from 2010 up until now, and how the caliber of businesses being sold and acquired and the caliber of investors has only grown and increased, and why you need to be on your game during due diligence as well. In fact, we do talk about buying businesses here. If you haven't got my due diligence framework, make sure you go away and get that. There'll be a link to that in the descriptions. It's what I use and many other people have used in terms of my clients, and a lot of people buying business from Empire Flippers have used this due diligence framework to acquire great businesses. So check that out. Justin and I also talk about when financing becomes a thing and what size acquisition people start to use finance, in terms of like outside lenders, SBA, seller financing, and different ways to finance in terms of seller notes and all that sort of stuff. We also talk about proof of funds. I asked a question to Justin on why do people need to show proof of funds to get access to the deals that you sell in your marketplace. I think it's a very good strategic move for everybody involved in acquiring a business from Empire Flippers. We also, Justin asked a couple of questions towards me, and we have a bit of a chat and a chin wag around how to hire the best mentors and how to decide which mentor is right for you based on what you want to achieve, how to hire a mentor or disregard hiring a certain mentor based on their character and philosophies and things like that. We also talk about creating an environment or community of people who are like you or who you aspire to be like, and how that can support you in your growth towards your goals and your career in the online business space. Now, there's so much value in this podcast episode. I'm sure you guys are going to love it. So let's just dive straight in. Do you have a website you might want to sell either now or in the future? We have a hungry list of cashed up and trained up buyers that want to buy your content website. If you have a site making over $300 per month and want to sell it, head to buyingonlinebusinesses.co/sell-your-business or email us at info@buyingonlinebusinesses.com, because we will likely have a buyer. Details are in the description. Justin, welcome to the pod.
Thanks for having me on, Jay. I appreciate it, buddy.
Yeah, it's been a while. It's been so long. We've got some health things to talk about, both you and me. I'll share with mine while I have this thing on my lip. I was surfing and I pulled off the back of a wave and sort of got a little bit airborne. And as you pull off the back of the wave, normally you'll pull the board underneath your belly and then land on the water and sort of like paddle back out. I went to do that and a bit of wind hit my board and turned it sideways, and I just like smashed my face against the side of my board and nearly put the tooth through it. It looked pretty like somebody thought I'd just like wrecked my whole face when I was out there, because like the blood and the water makes it look really bad. But just a couple of stitches, if people are wondering what that is. And also,
I was gonna say, by the way, that's a complicated excuse for getting smacked in the mouth by some kind of bawling.
Yeah,
you know
what I mean?
That's pretty
exactly.
I make you laugh too much. You go split it open even wider.
I don't split it open again. Now, a lot of my friends said, "Hey, you should just, you know, tell the story a bit different. Like you pulled into this crazy wave that was like four times overhead or something." Yeah, but also I want to say congrats, man. Like you, when I saw you, a video of you on YouTube, I was like, Justin is looking damn sharp. And yeah, congrats, man. Like you started talking about it before we hit the record buttons, and then I was like, well, maybe we chat about this on the pod. So yeah, congrats on being like a machine. You look like a machine now. Like it's sick.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I really appreciate it. We were talking before. I'll just kind of tell you the story. You know, we were for a long time. I felt like and this is completely wrong, and I'll explain why later. But I felt like I'd sacrificed my personal health a bit for the business. Like, you know, 10, 12 years ago, I was just so heads down, like trying to hustle up, make our business work at Empire Flippers, right? And I was like, you know what? I did the health stuff. I made an excuse. You know, the health stuff I'll put off. Well, in 2021, we were going to a conference. We had our company conference in Vegas. It was a blowout, you know, company retreat in Las Vegas. flying on the way there, I twisted my knee a little bit and I felt this pop and this like wave of adrenaline come over me. Like a good feeling, bad obviously, but like a good feeling. It was the strangest thing. And but we were flying, we were taking off, so there's nothing I can do about it. So I get up to go to the bathroom like an hour later and I realize I can't walk. I literally can't walk on my knee. And so, you know, the flight attendants come over and they bring like someone from the back, and my blood pressure is like 190 over 100. Anyone knows what blood pressure numbers should be? Those are not the numbers they should be. So some firefighters like, you know, take me off the plane. They ask if I want to go to the hospital. I say no. And I'm basically put in a wheelchair and I go to the Cosmopolitan in Vegas. And my wife wheels me in to the hotel. We get to our suite or whatever. And I'm just like, it was a real low point for me. I was like, I'm just screwed. I don't know what to do. So the next day we go to a knee surgeon, do an MRI. And he goes, look, it's a torn meniscus, right? Okay, torn meniscus. And he's like, but you know, the problem is, it's like, it's not just your knee, because we could fix your knee. If you need surgery later, we can do it. He's like, it's your weight. At the time, I was much bigger. I was almost 400 pounds, 380, 385 pounds. So I was a big boy. As you know, so the doctor's like, yeah, lose weight. I'm like, yeah, of course, lose weight, right? Yeah, I've heard that before. I thought of my first rodeo. And he's like, well, he's like, you know, it's like, it's going to be a real problem for your other knee or whatever. I was like, yeah, I know. He's like, no, you know, there's like ways to do this now. Like, we're not, I didn't say this, but we're not in the Stone Ages. You know, there's ways to do this. And he's like, you know, there's like a surgical option. And I was like, I don't know, man, doc, you know, surgery is really risky. And he like impressed on me. He's like, well, surgery is a little risky, but being that big is way more risky. And I hadn't thought about it that way. So, you know, when he put it that way, for me, it just kind of like something clicked and I started looking into it, and I made a decision to get what's called gastric sleeve, which is basically where they cut out a portion of your stomach and then you have to recover and you have to like change all your habits, eat really well, work out. So I made, after this is January 2022, I made a real focus on diet, nutrition. I hired a nutritionist, I hired a trainer, and I started learning how to cook. And so I really kind of changed my life to reflect kind of the new person I was becoming. And, you know, in the process, I lost about 170 pounds. I'm around 210 to 220 right now. It's kind of where I fluctuate, and in way better shape. I feel so much better. My blood pressure is normal. It, you know, dropped down normal. I don't have any medication. I feel quite healthy. That doctor really put it in a way for me that was super helpful. And so, as you know, every chance I get, I try to tell other people about it, because I feel like, you know, I'm like new converted Christian, where like trying to spread the word, you know what I mean? Like, that's how I feel right
that's
now.
That's so good, man. Congrats. Like, I have had some health crises in my life that I talk about with my friends and people as well, because it's so important. And you mentioned something about what you might be doing in the future in terms of media wise, and I also had a similar thing. I think most entrepreneurs go through this, especially when we're like, so when we really buy into the hustle, hustle, hustle phase of like our career or business. I got super sick that I got glandular fever and I didn't know. And it turned into Epstein-Barr virus, like a serious case. And I went to an alternate health doctor for something completely different, which is a year and a half later of getting glandular fever. And I just worked through it. And she's like, no, like, dude, you need to not work at all, or like do like 5 hours a week, 10 hours a week max. And I think it's really debilitating for us, and we're not very good for the business or our career when we do this, but I think we buy into the hustle culture so much. So looking forward to seeing like what you come out with in the future and how you discuss and talk about these things. But I want to dig into Empire Flippers, man. Like, congrats on what you guys have built. I just checked the stats. You say on your site, you're going to need to update it very soon, because you say $450 million worth of online businesses sold, but it's actually $490 million.
Yeah.
So you're close to the
500. Yeah, we're just under the 500. It's like 500-ish.
Yeah, 500-ish.
Yeah, 500-ish.
So cool. So when did you and Joe staff like co-found this? What year did you guys start that?
So we started, we started an outsourcing company in the Philippines around 2009. And then we moved to the Philippines in 2010 and we started a project. It wasn't even a company. Our outsourcing company is our main company. We started a project that we called AdSense Flippers. And the whole idea was to create niche AdSense sites, small little sites about silly stuff like catconstipation.net and like cremationprices.org, things like that. And monetize it via AdSense or Google AdSense. You put some code on your site and it displays ads for people and people click that and you get paid. And so we started building these little sites and we started, unlike everyone else who would like sell you a course on it or like give you some and hold the rest back for paid members or whatever, we're just like, look, we're just gonna put it all out there for free. Here's exactly what we're doing. Here's how we're building them. And it really resonated with people. At the time, that was kind of breaking the mold. And so, you know, we built up an audience of people that were kind of interested in what we were doing. And then when we started selling the sites, you know, people were like, I think a lot of people were just like us. Like, is this internet money thing real? You know, they were like, can you really make money on the internet? How's this work? And so they'd buy the sites just kind of like wanting to give it a scratch, right? Wanting to give it a try to see if it's legitimate. If you can make $100 a month, $200 a month from a website.
Yeah, that's cool, man. So that's like, so 2010, which is like around 14 years ago. So I wanted to ask you, you know, going from selling small little AdSense sites, which as we know now, time of recording is they're not the most ideal sort of media business to buy at the moment, just because of the environment, which will change. We know that. But so that's roughly 14 years of in M&A, mergers and acquisitions and selling businesses. What do you feel are maybe the top two things you've learned? They might be like strategies or philosophies or mindset things around M&A that would be good for acquisition entrepreneurs to know about.
Yeah. So one of the things I'll mention is that, you know, online entrepreneurs or online gurus or whatever you want to call them, there's a Johnny come lately aspect to what they talk about, right? And it's often around like who's ever offering the best affiliate commissions or has the hottest course or whatever kind of niche is the hottest. Right now it's AI, it's been crypto, it's been all kinds of things, right? And so you're going to have people talking about whatever the latest thing is, but that doesn't necessarily mean the other things are dead, right? So there's talk, I'm not even sure people are talking about it anymore, but talking about drop shipping is dead. There's people out there with drop shipping sites that are crushing it, right? Now, content sites are actually in trouble because of the SERPs, but there's people with content sites that are making a lot of money right now, a lot. But a lot of people got hit, to be fair. I'm going to be, you know, like that's, it's rough out there. And Google's struggling generally. But the bigger point, The bigger point though is that, you know, whatever people are talking about is not necessarily the area in which they're making money. So people have a lot of like geographical sites, content sites that are, what Pat Flynn had one a very long time ago, security guard training in certain areas or, you know, nursing, certified nursing courses in certain areas. There are sites just like that in similar niches that are out there crushing and making money. And that is that people have talked about that for 10 years. So yeah, I mean, it's not always about what people are the latest fad or the things people are talking about. There's people out there making money in niches that are old or that are dead.
I love that. I call it evergreen business models and evergreen niches because I think the best gains in our career and as an acquisition entrepreneur and in business and life come from compounding and come later down the track versus like, I need to make this money now, which I totally get. Like most of my audience is, hey, I need to replace my income. I do not like this lifestyle. And I get the rush and the absolute sheer drive to get out of that role or that sort of lifestyle and try and get income as soon as possible. But like what you're saying, to add to what you're saying is like, it's really those good, solid, stable businesses with evergreen niches in an evergreen business model that are going to provide years and years down the track and versus like having to get into like when dropshipping was a big thing. I see that you got three main business models, right? You've got media businesses, you've got SaaS and membership businesses or subscription type businesses, and then you've got e-commerce businesses. Drop shipping is just a type of e-commerce. Amazon FBA is just a type of e-commerce. Amazon FBA might not be that big in 10 years' time if somebody else comes out and just crushes Amazon, you know, and it's possible. People might be sitting here thinking, how is that a thing? Because it's Amazon. But it's possible. You look at big companies that have fallen, like Google's struggling right now as well, hence why content sites aren't doing so well. But it's content sites is just a type of media business. You can get traffic from other media sources other than Google.
Yeah, Amazon might not be out of business, but Shopify and Walmart might eat up some of their market share. So they're no longer a dominant party. There's other parties that are worth exploring and people are building sites on and that kind of thing. Yeah.
Outside of obviously business models and the industry of online businesses in itself, but I want to ask about the acquisition industry and how things have changed in that time from, say, 2010 to now, and how people are acquiring businesses. And then what do you see for the future of acquiring businesses, how it might change as well?
Yeah. So what we saw in, I'd say, 2010 through 2015, I mean, we saw a lot of unsophisticated buyers because a lot of the sites we were selling were much smaller content affiliate type sites. So it's really hard for me to say, you know, if it was the industry or if it was our kind of role in the industry. Come that as it may, I mean, buying online businesses or buying websites was, those were early days, right? And so we've seen a lot of growth in terms of the types of online businesses people are building, the diligence going into purchasing these businesses, the competition around both trying to sell your business against, you know, other businesses that are, you know, quality and looking good, and on the buy side as well. So you're competing with other people. If you're asking for seller financing, is the other buyer not? If you're offering 80% of list, are they offering 90%? So there's a bit more competition around that. I'd say right now, and you know, and I think you must have talked about it, like there's been a shift toward a buyer market. So there's a lot more like, you know, taking your time to find a quality business, trying to make sure you negotiate the best deal, get the deal at the best value is like, it's absolute best time to do that.
I've definitely noticed when I bought my first business, maybe 4 years after you guys started selling in 2014. And I was even on your podcast, you guys interviewed me, I think it was episode 188 called Newbie Norm, where I went from like plumber to, and yeah, I was an absolute newbie, like, and realized that and then got better and better at due diligence myself, and then realized people needed that. And I see that, not to like put myself on a pedestal or tout myself or toot my own horn, because there's other people that are doing similar things, but we've actually have helped people acquire better businesses. And by doing so, I feel it's helped people make sure they build better businesses. And just through the industry as it's grown, people are, like you said, building better businesses, selling better businesses, which means, you know, the acquirers need to be a lot more savvy, which is so key.
That's something that we haven't had a lot of in the industry, particularly in the earlier days. It's really started kicking, I think, I'd say since maybe 2019, 2020, is you see a little more buyer representation. So, you know, there are third-party companies that will help you with due diligence in terms of like kind of reports and that kind of thing. There's guys like you that will, you know, kind of give you a head check, either give you a head check and like review the business with you, or do a lot of the work and put together kind of a report for you. So those things are happening a bit more, kind of hold your hand as you kind of go through the process. And it's not a bad idea. I mean, it's been used effectively in the real estate market for a very long time. It's also helpful to have buyer representation, both on the legal end, but also the kind of like due diligence end, right? Because, you know, at the end of the day, at Empire Flippers, we're representing the seller's interest. Now, many times, you know, the buyer comes in, we're trying to work with both the buyer and seller, and we're trying to get deals done, trying to help the buyer get the deal done, trying to help the seller get the deal done. But we're trying to maximize value for our sellers, right? Ultimately, that's what we're trying to do. So, you know, having someone representing the buyers, I think, is pretty good. You know, Ace Chapman, right? Yeah, he was doing that before there was hardly anyone doing the kind of buy side representation. He's actually doing a lot of, I haven't talked to him for a while, but he's doing a lot of the offline businesses now.
He actually reached out to me maybe 2 years ago, and we're going to do something together. I haven't heard from him in a long time, but yeah, I learned a little bit from him in the early days as well. I think he helped me buy my third acquisition, or just overlook it with me, which is hugely, hugely helpful, right? And yeah, he's, you know, such a lord in the industry. But now he's moving into that, into a different sort of career choice, I guess. I don't know. Sorry, Ace, if we're incorrect, because we haven't spoken to you in a long time. Maybe all of us should just get on a
phone. Yeah, call us, man, and clarify, yeah, buddy. Yeah, call us back. Yeah. I was doing this like Facebook tag where I message him and then like a month and a half later, he get back to me.
Yeah, he's such a great guy. Yeah, so I was going to ask, you know, about how have you noticed buyers become more savvy, and of course through these methods, that's a thing. Now, also wanted to, you mentioned financing. When it comes to financing and acquisition, I noticed that sometimes you, like on the small acquisitions, obviously people have cash, they're going to win because it's financing can slow down the deal. Where does financing, in terms of using other lenders or using a lender to acquire business, what sort of size acquisition are you seeing that start to come in as of now?
Yeah, so you're going to see seller financing above at a kind of minimum, maybe like a $300,000 to $500,000 range, right? You're going to see sellers willing to finance a part of the deal, 20-30%. We're not talking, you know, 90% loan to value or anything, but 20-30% of the deal paid out over time, either guaranteed or earn out or whatever. And you'll see that up until like a couple of million, like low seven figures. And above that, you're often dealing with much larger kind of like roll-ups or organizations that, you know, have a portfolio of companies looking to just kind of like bolt this one into theirs. And so sometimes there's seller financing, but the deal structures get a little more complicated. You see some financing, we see some of like the operator investor partnerships where you have like one or two investors with the kind of like man on the ground operator that has the kind of nuts and bolts experience, and they kind of partner up to do deals. So the operator is getting a larger piece of the pie, putting a little bit of cash out there. The investors are putting out most of the money to get the deal done, and either taking notes or, you know, large piece of equity or both to get those deals done. But in terms of like, one thing that I thought would happen was that traditional finance would be larger in our space by now. And that hasn't materialized. I thought, and I was saying this, I think 3 years ago, that we see a lot more financing in our space, and that would definitely increase multiples, right? Because, you know, access to capital would improve that. I think maybe if interest rates would have stayed quite low, maybe that would have happened. But with increasing interest rates, the cost of capital went up a bit, and yeah, it just didn't materialize. So that surprised me a bit. I think that kept multiples from kind of going through the roof, which I think they might have otherwise. So, you know, in terms of multiples right now, it's a pretty good time to buy, particularly in that kind of like sub 3 million over 300,000 range, because it's kind of it's a sweet spot to buy because it's a tough range to sell in, right? So like, you know, there's not a lot of kind of like operators sitting around with 1.5 million in cash to buy a business. Right. So if you're looking to sell at that range, it's tough. Now, if you're trying to sell your $7 million business, there are like small private equity groups, portfolio companies that are looking to swallow up businesses of that size. But it's real tough if you're, you know, 800,000, 1.3 million.
Also, I notice, you know, working with these people that might have a mil in cash or 500K in cash or between 500 to maybe 2 million cash, they're not going to go buy with just cash. They're savvy enough to go, hey, I could get a portion of this financed through SBA or through, you know, some sort of source and not pour all of my capital into the deal, or put a big chunk of my capital into the deal, but also use finance to acquire a larger, maybe more stable, less risky asset. That's what I've noticed anyway. And so
SBA though is really hard to get done on online businesses. It rarely happens.
And so, do you guys offer that anymore? Like, do you guys even have people look? Cause I noticed that it was like, I don't know, might've been a year or two ago that there was less and less acquisitions happening with SBA through Empire Flippers. Yeah,
we do. It's offered, but like it so rarely gets done that it's not even worth spending a bunch of time on. In fact, we've spun our wheels on so many potential SBA deals that never materialized. It's ridiculous. And there's a whole host of reasons for that. But like, yeah, SBA loans do not love online businesses. I mean, for one, you know, when you're buying an offline business, right, there's often some physical real estate involved. There are some physical assets, right, that can be retrieved. I mean, when we talk about online businesses, it's really kind of bits and data, right? And so, you know, it's, you know, zeros and ones at the base of this thing. So it's really hard to, you know, kind of leverage that if you're a lender, right? And like, it's really hard to put any kind of like restrictions on that. So it's really difficult to lend against. I think that's really, you know, that's hurt the kind of financing the space. And again, kept multiples lower than you might see otherwise. I think, you know, because of the interesting nature of an online business where it can be run from anywhere, anyone in the world can buy it, right, and run it from anywhere, that the kind of like the opportunity there is huge, way bigger than a laundromat in Tulsa, Oklahoma, right? It's like, you know, let's say I'm in Sacramento and I see you've got a network of six laundromats in and around the Tulsa, Oklahoma area. That's cool, but I got to like move to Tulsa and, you know, I don't know how to run business in that, you know, city. I'm not doing that.
It gets very heavy in terms of like time resources and location resources for those types of businesses. And I get why people might want to buy them. However, also I noticed with the laundromat, like you might need to acquire to grow, you might need to acquire some more laundromats in the space, and you're really relying on the population of that area, not just foot traffic, but the population of the area, and your marketing pool or your audience is limited to that certain place or location, which is like you have this sort of like glass ceiling on a traditional business.
Sure. You also got low competition. You know, if you're coming in as like a national or international marketer and you're trying, I mean, you're just going to destroy the laundromat industry.
You come in with some AdSense skills, you know, digital marketing skills that you can, you know, fire up, you know, online, then you're going to crush it. Absolutely. But there's also a ceiling to that, right? Whereas with online businesses, like there's typically no ceiling and you can grow so much faster with minimal resources.
It's similar. One of our marketing director was at a conference and it was for like local business brokers. So like offline business brokers and stuff. And was talking to one of them, you know, kind of like explaining his marketing techniques. And he was like, you know, you guys really need to be out there like building an email list. And our guy's like, yeah, an email list is good, right? Of course, that's how we run our business, strictly through email. We got a couple hundred thousand of them. And then this guy's like, look, I do most of my business through email now. And I've got, can you believe it, 450 subscribers. And my guy's like, what? Dude, this is, and that's like a local broker, right? In the city or whatever, selling like local businesses or whatever. So, I mean, it makes sense, but like, we're like, oh my God, dude. Yeah, these guys are behind the times.
Yeah. 450 email subscribers. it's very, very different to the online space, right? And I think, there's so much opportunity in acquiring a physical business. I've thought about it as well, acquiring a physical business and then just putting my knowledge into that. You could grow it so fast, but also at the same time, Do I want to deal with that? Not really.
A lot of hassle too. What would you do if you're getting an offline business, some like kind of boring traditional business? Like, what would what kind of like juices you up in terms of like being able to market it?
In terms of marketing, it would be just taking over the audience. Like, I would definitely have local SEO done as a long term strategy. I would also definitely just get straight, depending on what the business is.
What kind of business would it be? What kind of like makes you get kind of excited? You think you could do something where they're branded out?
I'd probably have some sort of manufacturing business. I'd rather have it like be a B2B sort of business where we manufacture some sort of product and then sell it to a bunch of maybe dropshippers or suppliers or like, yeah, I'd probably.
That's interesting. Okay. Yeah. I thought you were going to go straight retail. All right. You like that B2B sales. You like those like high ticket closes.
Absolutely. Because then you can have less clients to deal with and you can earn more money. And I get where the risk ratio reward thing happens, where you might only have maybe three or four businesses that you're selling to, and you might lose one. You could lose 30% of your income. But you could pick that up.
There's a moat around that too, that's higher than like a nail spa or something, right? Like anyone had ever opened a nail spa.
Yeah, which is tough because the profit margins are so small. But then I would just, you know, I think I'd like to go to B2B, and then I could just do some outreach to, you know, I could just hire an outreach team to find a bunch of businesses that want to acquire our products that are really, really good. Or we could, you know, create a department in the manufacturing warehouse to actually manufacture products based on what that brand would actually want, and then just create that sort of deal. I do have a client that has, I've seen it work really well, where he is the retail, he sells retail and he acquires from a a manufacturer, and basically he built the whole business. He was a sales funnel. He was a sales channel. So I just look at different companies as like the sales staff, basically, for the manufacturing business, and just have really good policies put in place for protection and IP and all that sort of stuff. That's probably how I would go. I mean, that might be a bit more advanced than me people thinking about like buying a laundromat. But what would you do? Would you buy what sort of offline business would you buy?
God, now you got me thinking. I mean, it'd probably be service-based business, right? I like services. Services are kind of fun for me. It'd be fun for me to market.
Yeah.
A number of years ago, they were doing like the kind of maid service. And I think you can have a lot of fun like marketing that brand.
Definitely.
I think that's kind of fun. I don't know. Yeah, it'd probably be service-based though.
You could franchise that too. In Australia, we have this thing called Jim's Mowing, and they have a bunch of like in every city or like suburb, you have somebody that is a Jim's mower, and they will just hire Jim's Mowing, and then they'll just pair you up with somebody that will go and do your yard, you know, yard care and all that sort of stuff. And then they went from Jim's Mowing to Jim's Cleaning, and then to Jim's Cleaning to different sorts of things. So definitely
target the high end neighborhoods too. Like you just make so much more money. It's clearly like it's good. By the way, I don't even know if this is make the show, whatever, but like there's a niche out there that is crushing it. I have this personal friend, not business connection, but a personal friend of my wife and I's from the Philippines that we knew her back then. She's in the US now and absolutely crushing it with this, what is it? Like non-permanent, semi-permanent, like draw on the eyebrow. She's called Brow Queen. She's in North Carolina. Her brand name is Brow Queen. She's like good on TikTok. She does the Facebook reels and stuff, but she's crushing it. And their margins are huge. It starts like $500, $600 to get
really?
Done.
And it's like, non-permanent. It's not a tattoo. Dude. It's just like,
it's not a tattoo, but it is. I don't know. It's like semi, dude, I'm not the right person to ask about it. That's my wife, but it's like some kind of thing where it's like lasts a year or a year and a half or something, but they're making bank with that, dude, like real money. She's crushing it. I'm just so excited.
Yeah, that's
for
so
her.
Cool.
Yeah, like, on your third
congrats.
Shop.
Like while we're talking about a niche, I had this question in my group as well before, is like some people find it really, really hard to find a business in the niche that they like. I think that's a limiting belief. I'm not big into just focusing on a certain niche unless it's your passion, because most people that come to this realm are like, I want to just exit my job and I just want to make an income. So why are you focusing on niche so much when you should be actually focusing like, where do I just make the money? How do I make it least risky so I, you know, can stay out of a job? What are your thoughts on like people finding the right niche or buying a business in a niche that they like? I get there's some niches that are better than others, but
I totally agree that you don't have to have a passion for the niche. You're gonna find a passion for something in something in the air. So for example, let's say I love the kind of like I was just talking to a guy in the mastermind I'm in, whatever, and he does YouTube videos. He has a YouTube site, and he loves like the behind the scenes and like which thumbnail do I use and like the analytics of like trying to like dig into it. The videos, he's like, I like making them, but I love the trying to make them better and draw more eyeballs and like get them to stick longer on the video. You probably know all this stuff, right? So he loves he dorks out on this stuff. And so like the niche in specific, he's in like the barbecue niche. But like, who cares? You know, he doesn't really, he likes barbecue and it's cool, but he's not like loves barbecue. He's not like deeply passionate about it. He just likes the kind of like digging into the data, and like that's something he loves to do. It's fun for him. So yeah, I mean, you're going to find something in your business. Maybe you're a people person. Maybe you like to mentor people. And so having kind of like junior employees or kind of like apprentices, depending on what your business is, that are kind of like up and coming and you can guide them and kind of like show them the way. Maybe that's the fun part for you, even though you're kind of, you know what I mean? You're going to find something in your business that you love to do.
And like anything, there's some parts of life that you don't love to do. Like I don't like cooking. I don't like cleaning in my life. Same in some parts of my businesses. Like I don't like that task. In fact, like it makes me feel like restricted if I'm working on this thing. And there's only a certain phase, typically if you stay in business for the rest of your career, there's only a certain phase that you need to go through where you need to wear all the hats and do all that sort of stuff for only a certain period of time until you get to the point where you go, nah, I don't like this part. And then I really love this part. I just want to do what I'm good at and what I like. And then I can hire somebody to do what I'm not good at, which they actually like to do. and it's just a phase.
Jared, you got to get through the suck. Sorry? That's the truth, right? You got to get through the suck. And the beginning part of your business, you're wearing all the hats, you're doing all the work because you have to figure everything out. No one's going to like hand it to you on a silver platter. You have to go through the ropes and figure out the process. Once you do that, you can start handing that off. Now that makes it worse at times, right? Because now not only do you have to do all the work, but you have to find someone worth hiring, hire them, onboard them, and then train them to do the work while doing the work yourself. Like that's the shittiest it gets, right? Once they're trained and they're working on it, then you're like, okay, I can breathe. But that process can be grueling.
Can be grueling. And I just consider it training as well. Like it's a really good training piece for me because mindset wise that if these smaller little challenges that pop up, what it is just getting me ready for these larger challenges that happens in business and life that when they do come, I'm not freaking out. I don't lose my hair. I don't lose my marbles. I have the capacity because I've slowly trained my way up to be able to deal with those larger problems or problems that may seem very, very stressful for somebody that's starting out. But if you work your way up to it, it makes it so much easier. So I think people it's most of us are just, we want things without having to do the work. But the reality is it's like the journey. It's about the journey, not the destination, right? It's so cliche, but really like you need to become the person, you need to do that training to become the person that deserves to have those sorts of results or achieve those sorts, certain things. Have you noticed that in your career?
Yeah, I'd say that early stage, it's actually very helpful to have failures. Later too. I mean, you learn from failures, obviously, but like to have those failures and then to get back up and start, you know, making it work again or kind of building back, that's really helpful in understanding that I can fail, I can have these setbacks, and I can work through it. Right. And it's empowering to some degree because you do it a couple of times and then you're like, okay, I think I know how to weather these storms. And then another one hits you. You're like, okay, well, this is a new challenge. How do I figure this out? And you start to get good at problem solving. Right. And that's such a valuable skill to have as an entrepreneur because it's always one shoe dropping after another. Right. There's one bad thing happening, or then there's Google updates and there's Amazon account issues, and there's all kinds of things that can happen in business. So being able to like start to try to anticipate where the shoe is going to fall and like put yourself in a better position to deal with it falling is a great position to be in. I went through these problems and now I see it all and now I can't do it either. Like I'm just saying like, you know, that we have our own problems. I get shit on too. I screw up now, right? So it's not like I figured it all out. It's just, I at least know what I don't know, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And you're only going to keep making, like if you're like me, you're going to just keep making failures and it's great because they're the lessons and they help you make you very, very resilient. Like those failures is like they put you in the gym, you get a slap in the face. Like you only, like if you get hit in the face, like I did from my surfboard, I'm only going to learn from it far better. You know, like, yeah, yeah. People are going to be a bit upset if I don't ask this question about Empire Flippers. A lot of people ask me like, why do I need to provide proof of funds to be able to see some listings through Empire Flippers? And I totally get it on your part. I think it's a very, very smart move. Why wouldn't you? There is a lot of time wasted with people wanting to acquire assets that may not have funding that are just, you know, kicking the tires really. Is that the main reason? I'm sure there's other reasons within that as well. But yeah, talk to me a little bit about why we have people submitting proof of funds.
Yeah, so we provide, you know, a full service experience, right? And so oftentimes, particularly in the larger businesses, you're having our own salespeople that are guiding the seller through the process, walking the buyer through the process, doing a lot of work on both ends. So to make sure that we're protecting their time, right, is important. And again, you mentioned it, to make sure we're protecting the seller's time. The reason we're able to get such high quality businesses at Empire Flippers is because sellers know if I go there, I'm not going to be dealing with, you know, two dozen tire kickers. I'm not going to have my time wasted and like in the ups and downs of someone's interested. No, they're just fake. Someone else is interested. Oh, they're fake too. So you know that you're dealing with someone who has proof in the pudding, who has the funds to back it up. And so you're not just dealing with tire kickers. And so that's one of the reasons we're able to attract the much higher quality businesses, is because we have that kind of process in place. So, and there's also just a general kind of like weeding technique. Look, to be clear, we lose people that may have bought businesses with us at Empire Flippers because they just don't want to send proof of funds. They just like are principally against it or something, right? And there's a number of people we lose because of that. I'd say a small number, but a number of people. But for all the other people, all the tire kickers, all the time wasters that we don't have to deal with, it's worth losing a small number of legitimate buyers that, you know, don't appreciate the process. And it's worth it for our sellers too. So yeah, I mean, you know, it's a part of our process that saves our people time, saves the sellers time. And it's just a really good weeding process from our perspective.
Definitely. Definitely. I think it's a great way to go. I would be doing the same. So what's next to Empire Flippers then? What's next for you, Justin? What's next for Empire Flippers?
Yeah. So, you know, we talked about this before we even got on, right? I'm no longer involved in like the day to day with Empire Flippers, or even the week to week. We have Andy Alloway, who effectively runs a company. I'm also a partner and involved with Joe and Mike Vrankovich over at WebStreet. So I help out a little bit with the marketing over there, some of the webinars, some of the work they do. But again, you know, not my day to day. You know, I find myself feeling much more of like an advisor role to both businesses at this point, working with them when they need it, doing interviews or whatever they need. But yeah, it's spending a lot of me time. I mean, obviously with the kind of like the weight loss, the working out has been different. I cook a lot, Jared, honestly. And I told you, one of the projects I'm working on right now, I want to start a podcast around pivots. So I've had some like life and business pivots in the last couple of years. And I've talked to a lot of entrepreneurs that have been going through or are going through similar things right now. And it's like trying to navigate those pivots, trying to come out of them on the other side and be able to not just kind of be blown around in the wind, but actually pick a direction and kind of chart your course, I think is super important. And so I'm working on a show that I think will help with that. It's been a while since I've done any podcasting. I was talking to you about how impressive your YouTube channel is. I hope I can build it up like you, but yeah, it's great, man.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate that shout out. I have so much to say about pivoting, for even just pivoting from a career to acquiring an online business or being in online business and then pivoting a different way, or in life, like, I have mentors, all different types of mentors for all different things. You know, spiritual mentors, mindset mentors, all that sort of stuff that sort of helped me get through and make decisions based on.
What's your decision process for like bringing a mentor? How do you find them and like how do you vet them?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So when I'm looking for a mentor, I want to find somebody that has either achieved what I want to achieve. And then I would preferably go through. Now I don't actively seek mentors now. This is when I first started out. I think there's different phases for getting mentors and different phases of life.
But it depends on what you're doing. Let's say you want to be good at Brazilian jiu-jitsu, right? And I don't know, maybe you're an expert, but like let's say you want to get good at that. You probably need some kind of mentor, coach, guide, to help you with that, unless you've done it a long time already. So not just in a business sense, but generally, like what do you look for when you're looking to like kind of like find or vet a mentor?
So again, it's going to be dependent on how much weight I put into the goal and the task. For Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, I'm like, I back myself physically and mentally. I could just go and find somebody that's really good at Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in my area and just work with them and start off from scratch. And then what I'd look at doing is I'd look at like leapfrogging to a better, if I wanted to become like a professional BJJ fighter or roller, whatever it is, then I would go away and look at like who is the best in the world at the task, but also who has like the the mental game. Like, I'm really big on the mental game. I think the mental game far outweighs like the physical game, and who can help me unlock certain things in that realm as well. And
well, I think that's big at BJJ, but yeah, so you're saying like, look for someone a couple levels above that can get you the basics, then look for someone a couple levels above that can teach you. You don't want to go on a business level. I don't want to go to like Elon Musk. Like, if I sat down with an interview with Elon Musk, like, what can I learn from that guy so far ahead? I mean, it'd be really interesting. I'd be fascinated. I wouldn't say no, but like, it just, if I was looking for someone to like learn from, he's just a tough case. Yeah, also, because he's like so far ahead.
Also, like,
yeah, sure. When does it matter? So like, it matters with like Elon. Okay, if you're looking for like an entrepreneurial guru or like a guide or coach or something, what kind of life they live? Are they married? Are they happily married? Do they have kids or not? Do you want kids? Like that shit matters. In like. Because entrepreneurial lifestyle is real similar. Like there's a lot of overlap, a lot of tie-ins right there. So yeah, you do want to look at like what kind of life they're leading outside of their entrepreneurship, because they may be crushing it. They may have a ton of money, but they may be miserably unhappy. And like that's, you know, there's a relationship there that you have to pay attention to. Where I don't give a shit about the chef I hire to help me cook like healthy food. That guy can be cheating on his wife. He can be banging the maid. I just don't care. You know what I mean?
But if you're going to hire somebody that you want to really look up to and like live a similar way, then I believe it's worth looking at their character and looking at the philosophies they carry and how they walk through life in many different ways. To ensure that you keep your own philosophies, you keep yourself grounded, and you actually stick to what you feel. I also believe that one really good thing is like prove everything, like test everyone, test every mentor, test every person, test everything that everybody says. Like one thing that I like to do is I like to listen to billionaires talk about some stuff, and like sometimes they talk about hustle things, that sometimes they talk about mindset stuff, and I'm like, for me, I'm not a billionaire, but like I do not agree with that. And that is not something that I would abide by or I would carry into my life and take for myself. I believe that so many people these days are where I was, and I totally get it. When I first started out, I was pretty desperate for all the knowledge, and I would just follow what everybody that did that was successful to a T. In fact, that actually ruined me, because, and this is why I got glandular fever and Epstein-Barr virus, is I once hired a mentor to build out my coaching side of the business when I first started buying online businesses. And we did just under $500,000 in our first year and had a bunch of clients, hired a team, and I just worked too hard, and it all went to crap because I was single source dependent on Facebook ads. Facebook shut down my ad account, and then I had all this team I had to pay, and I was just absolutely miserable from it. And I just built the wrong business model based on what I learned from somebody else that was successful and made a lot of money. You know, he was crushing it, and I followed the model and I made a lot of money, but my life was in shambles. So yeah, it's really testing people and asking the questions of like, does that resonate with me? Like, I don't know if you make many decisions from your gut, Justin, but I think it's pretty important, right? Do you do much of that?
Yeah, no, it's intuition. There's a certain level. So like, and testing people. So, okay, I was looking for a surgeon, right, when I did the surgery, and like I went out like an entrepreneur. I interviewed a bunch of surgeons. I asked them very point blank questions. How many people died on your table? How many people died within 30 days of the surgery? And in one case, I knew for a fact that a guy had died because the family sued him after the fact. He was straight up about it, very honest about it. And like that, I didn't go with him, but that wasn't the reason. Like if he had lied to me, guaranteed, or if he just said, oh, no one ever, I absolutely wouldn't have gone with him. So yeah, I mean, I test people in that way. I think the other thing is like what got them there may not get you there. So people ask me, it's like, how did you get started marketing? How did you get Empire Flippers off the ground? What'd you do? Like, what are the first, you know, 10 things you did for the first year that got you traction in Empire Flippers? It's like, shit, man, I don't know if that's going to help you. Because what we did in 2011, right, to market Empire Flippers, you know, Squidoo pages, like, you know, like, what are you asking for, dude? Like, because it's probably not going to help your business today. So, and you have to be careful giving advice too, because like, okay, this helped us then, but it was a specific period of time in which, you know, the rubber met the road and it kind of worked out. I can't guarantee that's necessarily going to work for you today or anyone today.
Yeah. I noticed what you did then as well with you know, when you're looking for a surgeon is you tested different surgeons against each other as well. Like that's really, really fair. And I think people might have like, oh, Jared, yeah, of course I'm going to test. I'm going to find three different mentors and work out which one was the best one for me. And I'm going to use my gut and my intuition to use the best one. Yeah, great. But that's not the end. That's not the end, right? I think what you should do is when you find that best one of three, use them and always keep finding other mentors that may be able to be more beneficial for the stage you're at, like based on what you're saying.
Ask them who taught them or who they work with or what masterminds they're in, what groups they're in too. Yeah.
I've looked at mentors that are in the M&A space and all that sort of stuff. And just, I've just gone, no way would I work with them based on their character, based on the way they speak, based on how I believe they treat people, based on how it makes me feel. And I think that's super important for people to understand is like try and not just follow somebody, but work out who you are in the process so you don't only become a follower. And what I mean is only become a follower. You don't know who you are and you only follow people. Like work out who you are in the process, right?
Well, in the M&A industry, but just in business in general, trust is so critically important. You know, and my business partner and I, Joe and I, have been in business for a very long time now. And, you know, we've had our ups and downs in terms of partnership. And we've had times where we trust each other more or less. But like in the end, like I know he's got my back, right? I know that he's both self-interested and we have aligned interests, right? And so we've kind of kept our business in a way to where our own self-interests are always generally aligned. So we're working toward the same goal.
That's a really good tip for people that are in going in partnership. For just even relationship, like what makes you happy in your relationship is actually going to make your partner happy because you're going to be a better person to be around in terms of like an intimate relationship. But also in business, what other things have you learned through your partnership with Joe that has been hugely beneficial?
Contracts are important, but trust is in the end, like you're not going to be able to not legislate, but you're not going to be able to contractualize everything. Right? You're not going to cover every potential scenario that could ever happen. In the end, there's going to be some certain level of trust. And so you have to like build a framework, you know, through a partnership agreements or through, you know, we have like even unwritten rules. So we have a veto power at Empire Flippers. So either one of us can revert from doing what we were planning on doing and revert to the status quo with veto power. And so we very rarely use it. But like, you know, there are times where Joe's like, dude, I really don't want to do this. If you continue pushing on this road, on this change, I think I would veto it. I'm like, oh, okay, well, maybe I should stop spinning my wheels. And that's a rare thing. You rarely throw that out, but if you're so adamantly against it. So that kind of brings us back to status quo. Sometimes it pulls me or reins me back in from doing whatever kind of crazy harebrained scheme. And maybe it would have crushed it, right? But he just doesn't want to do it. So reins him in. And then I can rein him in on his end too. So it kind of keeps us a little more steady state.
What some people may not have picked up on that you mentioned just now is that before you even would get to a point where you'd have to veto something is communication. You guys, seems like you guys are constantly in communication. Like how often do you guys, I mean, it's probably less now because your partnership is, you know, so many years, more than a decade now, right? So it's probably less because you know each other so well, you know their values, you know what they're.
Early days, it was daily. Like we'd be multiple times. In fact, when we started Empire Flippers, we were living in a townhouse together. So it was all the time. Now it's once a week, maybe twice a week. So we still talk pretty regularly. And this is like, you know, we don't even do the quarterly updates to the team anymore. So like, you know, this is just us kind of keeping it. Like we're talking about his investments, my cooking. He's losing some weight and like putting some muscle on. We're joking about how hard that is to do over 40, by the way, Jared.
Yeah, I'm not excited for that.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, so we're talking about that, but we also, you know, keep each other updated on the business and, you know, interests and kind of what the market's like. So
yeah, cool. I think it's so good to have just, I've been traveling with, well, I'm not traveling. I live here in Bali now, but I always have people come and go, and the people that come and go are either family or they're friends, and those friends, they're entrepreneurs. Most of my family's entrepreneurs as well. So we end up always talking about our investments, our business. We just talk about what's important in our life, and it's so important to have those people that are on a similar path to you to just bounce ideas off outside of it being a transactional conversation, I guess. And did you notice that when you first started in online entrepreneurship that you started breaking away? I don't know what you did before AdSense flippers, but did you break away from a sort of like community or a group of friends, or not just break away, but like slowly remove yourself? Like I've definitely done that in my life, and not remove myself sometimes consciously, but mostly brought in fresh blood in terms of like other relationships and people that are more aligned with where I'm at in my life. How important have you found that for you in your life?
Yeah. So when Joe and I started Empire Flippers, it was right before that we'd started, Tribe EPO was our outsourcing company at the time. We had like packed up and left the US. So we're living in the US, working for an SEO company. We'd set up this outsourcing company to serve or to service our the company we worked for. And then we moved abroad. And the only person we knew there was employed by us in the Philippines. So, I mean, we left home, left everyone, and went to go build our business in the Philippines. And that was, we had friends and coworkers and family, obviously, back in the States. And we didn't know anyone. So it sucked. I mean, we had to make new friends and try to like figure that out. But we got kind of lonely. We're out in a Philippines island, trying to build this business, living in a townhome, just trying to like hustle it up. And so that's when we found a group called Dynamite Circle. So that's when we found those guys that were doing this kind of like remote business building. They call it Coconut Cowboy stuff at the time. And that kind of resonated with us. We were like, look, there's other people building businesses abroad and like outsourcing and trying to build internet companies. That's kind of fun. Let's hang out in that community. And so we started with them like right when they were starting out. And then we all kind of came up together. So their businesses they built and sold, like we all kind of came up together in this kind of like expat entrepreneurial community. And that was super helpful in terms of like, we had immediately had like a new growing friend base and kind of like support base of other people doing similar stuff with similar interests. So it's really weird, Jared, and you probably know this going back to Australia, seeing old friends or just kind of being around the people you would have been around if you'd stayed. And just like the disconnect, like it's really hard to relate to the same things. It's really hard to connect on the same things. Certain things that like you probably go surfing with some old buddies and you guys are just like, that's great, right? That's magic. But like when you're talking about like interests or whatever, I used to be into sports when I was in the US. I'd watch football at least and stuff. I had like a fancy football team. I came back to the US. I don't care about any of that. I don't pay attention really.
Part of the reason I live in Bali is number one, the surfing, but also back in Australia, I found myself going back after trips and just not living the same lifestyle as my friends and family, and realized like, wow, like when I come to Bali, I feel like actually inspired to do work. There's certain pockets in Bali, like I feel like Canggu, you've got a bunch of digital nomads or entrepreneurs that are like sort of like really hustling and trying to make it work and get their start. Where I live in Uluwatu, you're just a bunch of ballers here that actually make money, and it's really good to be where I'm at in my phase. I'm not saying that I'm absolute balling, but it's really good in where I'm at in my life now to be around those certain people, and they have a similar.
It's just that the levels of the game, Jared, are insane, right? So like, you want to go like see like kind of the startup, like nose to the grindstone, kind of working out. Go to like Chiang Mai, Thailand, right? And you just got like hustlers there, right? They're just building their business and trying to get it going and make something out of nothing, and it's fun, right? There's a real energy there from like kind of the younger entrepreneurs, and then you have like the people they're doing a little bit better. Maybe they're kind of like professional or whatever, and they might be in Saigon or Bangkok, or whatever. And then you just keep different levels. And then you go to like, Monaco, and you're like, so that's what the top guys are doing. They're just hanging out in their yachts. Like, okay, it's insane. And you're like, oh my God, this is and where are you comfortable? That's another thing too. Like what level of wealth, not would you want, because sure, you want Monaco and $1 million yachts. But like aside from that, where like feels good? Is it good? I don't know what it is, but you get a sense on like where you wouldn't mind hanging out for a while, like in what kind of like bracket you'd be comfortable being in. Maybe you're like, I want to live in San Diego and I want to live pretty well. Maybe that requires me to make, $15,000 to $18,000 a month. And like at that level for me, that's super comfortable. I want kind of steady Eddie paycheck, and like that's good for me. So you need to figure that out.
I guess a lot of people at the start don't have the privilege of just like relocating and being anywhere, especially if you've got family. But you can build that. You can build those. I know that on the Gold Coast, I built that before I left. Gold Coast is the town that I lived in Australia. I built that where we had every second Friday, we'd have like a a lunch with just friends and we just talk business. And then I ended up just slowly migrating and moving in towards hanging a lot more time and spending more time with those sorts of people. So it can be done in that certain location where you maybe did grow up or whatever. But I feel the moving part is like, it actually makes these energetic shifts within you and these math, because you just see the world differently based on where you're at and being around that sort of community, it changes. Like when you go to Monaco, you're not thinking about certain things that you may have thought about where you previously lived that in business. You're thinking about like, how did this person even get that deal? Or how did this person do this? You know, you don't think in the terms of like income expenses the same way you did in that certain location than you might have where you previously lived, right?
These guys aren't thinking about making money. They're thinking about like asset protection. They're like, how do I diversify across different countries so that one country can't take my money and the other one? They're a different level, insanely different. So like the levels to that, it's wild to see, right?
It is. Justin, it's been so fun to chat. Didn't feel like an interview or anything like that. I just felt like just hanging out with a mate. So I really appreciate it.
That's what we're doing, man. Just hanging out. I want to see you in Bali, man. You be there a while?
Yeah.
If we come down, I don't know if we're going to be there, but if we do get there this year, I'd love to.
Yeah, let's know. I'll be here all this year, next year. I haven't got a time frame of like how long I'm going to stay or move, but I'll be here for the next few years, I'd say for sure. Yeah.
Cool, man. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Good hanging out, man.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, Justin. Speak to you soon.